In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today we'll continue with part two of my interview with David Leaf, author of the seminal and recently updated Beach Boys biography titled God Only Knows, The Story of Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the California Myth. We'll talk about the unfinished Smile album, Wilson's father Murray, Brian's relationship with psychologist Eugene Landy, the success of Smile as a live performance, Brian's continued success as a solo artist, and how David's relationship with Brian changed from chronicler to close friend. First, though, here's some of the Beach Boys' Surf's Up, originally intended for Smile, but later served as a title song to the group's 1971 album. It's Surf's Up from the Beach Boys in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
The diamond necklace plays upon, and a handsome drum to la wall, to a handsome man at baton. A blind class aristocracy, back through the opera glass, you see the pit in the pendulum drum. Columnated ruins, diamond. Canvas the town and brush the back door. Are you sleeping?
So, I think you alluded earlier as we were talking that Brian had given four reasons for not finishing Smile, but you didn't enumerate them at the time. And I know one is Mike Love didn't like it. Another was that Brian thought it was too experimental. Three is the fire tape was too scary. And that lastly, people wouldn't understand where his head was at the time. You mentioned also, as we've been talking about Brian, repeating, if he, like in interviews, if he repeats the same thing a number of times, it's probably a good indication that's where the truth is with him, more than likely. These reasons that he gave about Smile, do you think those are the real reasons? Those are the things that sort of have continually manifested themselves as to why it was just given up on?
Yes. First of all, a lot of people told me that Mike Love didn't like the lyrics to Smile. Mike Love himself has said that he didn't find the lyrics relatable. Carl Wilson, in the terrific Don Was documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, which is on YouTube if you want to watch it. Carl talks about, I like the lyrics, Mike didn't. So I know that's a true reason. I'm talking to Van Dyke Parks as well, who was the lyricist. In terms of the other issues, I think those are true reasons that Brian couldn't articulate at the time.
Yeah.
It was what he was feeling. And I think the saddest part of the Smile story is that if we go back to our Beatles Beach Boys comparison, the Beatles had an ever evolving vision of their music and the world. Mm-hmm. The Beach Boys were a family business. And whether it was said to him or not, and I think it was said to him more than once by his father, and there was certainly a lot of grumbling at vocal sessions from what Brian's engineer Chuck Britz told me, from what Tony Escher told me, from Van Dyke Parks told me, from what the musicians told me. He did not feel that he had 100% support for the music. And Brian needed 100% support. The record company was not supporting him 100%. It's all kind of, in retrospect, it's very strange. People look at Pet Sounds as a failure. It reached number 10 in the charts. Wouldn't It Be Nice was a top 10 hit. God Only Knows was a top 40 hit. Sloop John B was a top five hit,
right.
And it's like, why was this album regarded as a failure? And it wasn't a failure. It was turned into a failure by what Capitol did, as opposed to saying, Brian, this is great. We want more like this. Keep going. You got the Beatles on their heels. They're blown away by what they're hearing. You're our American Beatles. Keep going. Nobody was saying that to him except his musicians and his friends. But his friends weren't his family, and his family was the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
So he wasn't getting that support. When I asked him that question in the documentary Beautiful Dreamer about why he stopped working on Smile, my sense, now think about this, he put it on the shelf in 1967. This documentary was made in 2004 when he finally finished Smile and presented to the world as Brian Wilson presents Smile. That's 37 years, right? Every interview he ever did was, hey, Brian, are you ever going to finish Smile? You've been asked this repeatedly. My sense when I asked him the question was the way he answered me, the force with which he answered me, what he says before he gives me the answers. Do you really want to know the truth from my heart? It was like, if I answer you, David, do I never have to answer this question again? That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
It felt like we were in the confessional.
After this first breakdown, he relates a lifelong hang-up to his mom, Audrey. And that doesn't get revealed. I mean, I think it's sort of inferred that it has to do with his relationship with his father.
Right.
Is that what we go with? Is that the good assumption?
The fact that when Brian has his breakdown and he says, when I get to the airport in L.A., I don't want anyone other than my mother to be there to meet me. I don't want my father there. I don't know what else to infer from it. There is a duality to Brian that's fascinating. His father taught him to be competitive. His father taught him to be loyal when Brian was young and when he was a teenager. So people don't think of Brian as an athlete. He was the center fielder for his high school football team. He was the quarterback of his high school football team. The Beach Boys were just his new team. So he needed to be loyal to them, according to his father, and he needed to be competitive with everybody else in the world of music. Now, those were good driving forces until they weren't. And so when Brian unloads on his mother, when I asked her, she refused to tell me.
Yeah.
And there were things she did tell me on the record. There were things she said, well, you can use this, but you have to use this anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a side notion, when the book first came out in 1978, I got a call late one night from Dennis Wilson. Where did you get this thing about, you know, me and the group? And I said, Dennis, it's from an anonymous source. I want to know who told you that, David. I said, well, Dennis, ordinarily I wouldn't tell you, but in this case, I'll make an exception. It was your mother. He goes, well, why'd you believe her? And then realizing the absurdity of what he said, he burst into laughter. There's a side of Brian where he hated his father and he loved his father.
Right.
To the point that in the late 60s, even after his father sold his publishing out from under him for less than $1 million, and we read today about publishing deals where Springsteen and Dylan and others are getting hundreds of millions of dollars for their publishing, Murray Wilson sold Brian's publishing for less than $1 million. even after that, even after Murray Wilson basically said to his son, your songs are no longer worth anything to me, I'm going to sell them and get one last payday. Brian wrote a song with him. There's no explaining things like that. There's no purity to the dislike or the like. It's a mixture of emotion that Brian has been roiled with his entire life. How do you love somebody who hits you, who yells at you, who screams at you, who tells you you're no good?
And you've alluded to this, the father is doing these abusive things, and then he's going to bat for the band and for his boys, to the record company, to in a sense sticking up for them. And it's just so weird.
Well, think of 1962. Now go back 5 years prior to that. Where are the Beatles? The Beatles are just starting. They're John and Paul are in a group. They invite George to join. Ringo hasn't joined yet. They're spending years learning how to be a band, dreaming of what John called, getting to the toppermost of the poppermost. 5 years it took them before they got a record deal, thanks to the vision of a manager who believed in them, Brian Epstein. The Beach Boys didn't exist. They didn't even call themselves the Beach Boys. They wrote a song, and within 5 months, not 5 years of working, within 5 months, they're on the hit parade in Los Angeles. They're playing a concert. They had not put in the time. It came too easily to them. It was like they had won the mega lottery. They were teenagers. They didn't know what to do with it. The Beatles were really hardened by the time they were successful. And they had a core group who, even though they weren't blood related, they were family. There wasn't anything they wouldn't do for each other. When the Beach Boys became successful and Murray Wilson appointed himself the Beach Boys group manager, it was, no one knew how long it was going to last. And it was like, okay, this is a whole lot better than working in a gas station. How much money can I get while this lasts? So it was about fame and fortune and groupies. It was not about making great records. That just happened to be a byproduct of Brian Wilson's genius.
So we've talked about Murray and the father, and he's one of several really controlling forces over the course of Brian's life. Another being, the band itself and his relationships between those members, and then later on this psychologist Eugene Landy. Now, so it's Murray. There are aspects of Murray that were positive. That has to be sort of, he was as difficult and a human being as possible, but there are good things that he did do that doesn't excuse, really abuse and so forth. Well, these other two entities, the band and Landy, well, what would you call, if any, good aspects from them exerting influence over Brian?
Well, the Beach Boys were an amazing vocal aggregation. There's nothing like it in the history of rock and roll. When Dennis and Carl were alive and singing with Brian and his cousin Mike, there was a DNA, we talk about blood harmony like the Everly Brothers. It's just a sound. Al Jardine, great, great singer and harmony singer. So they were bringing to life what was in Brian's head. So it was a beautiful, beautiful sound. There were aspects of every member of the group that were positive, but as a group, they went from the top, Good Vibrations is a number one single, to within 2 years playing a concert where a couple of hundred people showed up. Their fall after a five-year rise was so staggeringly swift that none of them knew how to handle it. Because they didn't have, none of them were educated. So they were looking to Brian to rescue them from this. And Brian was not interested in doing that. As Brian's first wife, Marilyn Wilson, said in a documentary, she said they really tore him down and said, "You think this is so easy? You guys do it." So Brian had abdicated the throne, if you will. And he was not going to reassume the throne unless somebody more powerful than the Beach Boys were there to make him do it. And psychologist, Eugene Landy, was hired. And Brian produced his first Beach Boys album in nearly a decade with 15 big ones. It was not a good record. It is not a good record. It was not up to their standards by any measure. And Landy was fired within the year. He was brought back in 1982 when I believe and others believe that Brian was in a death spiral,
right,
that he was not going to live much longer. Whether it was weeks, months, or a year or two, I can't say, but he was in terrible, terrible, terrible shape. And Dr. Landy was brought in to save Brian. So he asked, what are the good aspects of Dr. Landy? Well, he got Brian back into shape. It took somebody, what he once said, there's only room in Brian's head for one crazy person, and I'm going to be that crazy person.
Oh, man.
So he did that. There are two other things that he did that are often overlooked. I don't even remember how much I said about it in the book. It is in 1986, 87, as Brian is getting back into good shape and making music and writing great songs, he didn't bring those songs to the Beach Boys. Landy got a solo deal for Brian at Warner Brothers Records. Now, Landy wasn't the reason the deal happened. It happened because Brian was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and sang a beautiful version of On Broadway, inducting Lieber and Stoller and two record company executives, Lenny Waronker and Seymour Stein, said, "Hey, we should have Brian do a solo album." But if not for Landy, Brian wouldn't have been at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by himself, and the deal wouldn't have happened. So in a sense, we owe Brian's solo career to Landy. During the course of the making of that album, Landy always had Brian doing these things to normalize him, crazy things. Like he had Brian go into a car dealership to buy a car. So Brian bought a car from a saleswoman, and Landy decided that Brian should date this saleswoman. So he arranged a date.
Wait a minute. Now that I don't think comes out in the book. I didn't realize that. So he sends him in to buy it, and then he decides that he should date her. Then he later decides that he should stop dating her, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And that woman, Melinda Ledbetter, now Melinda Wilson, was the primary force in getting rid of Landy. As somebody said, she was the Trojan horse that Landy created. So if you ask, what did he do that was good? He saved Brian's life. He was the reason Brian began a solo career for real, and he's the reason Brian met his second wife, and the reason Landy was excommunicated from Brian's life, because he had become not just controlling, but had it was so exploitive, it was unbelievable in terms of economics and writing lyrics for songs. He was impossible to be around.
So the original book comes out in 78, and the next edition is some 7 years later, 85. And there's a big change that occurred in those 7 years that has to do with your relationship with Brian. Can you fill us in on how that relationship changed from being on the outside to being on the inside?
Absolutely. You know, Manfred, earlier on, you used the word mission in describing what I was doing. The first book was a journalistic mission. I want to kind of grab the world by the collar and go, hey, do you realize who this Brian Wilson guy is and how important he is and what's going on in his life? Would you pay attention and do something? Would you help this guy? So that's who I was on the outside. By the time the book came out, I had become, what I came to realize is that Brian was always putting himself in difficult situations. And there was guardian angels everywhere who would realize, oh, that's Brian Wilson. We need to drive him home. We need to take care of him. We need to take him in. We need to give him a meal. Whatever it was, these people were looking after Brian Wilson. And in the course of the period between the first book and the updated edition, I became associated with these people. There weren't a lot of them. But I became somebody that Brian trusted because I was associated with him. We became friends. And there were so many sad moments. I don't want to dwell on them, but I remember one Christmas, going with a friend of his to a hospital that Brian was in. And she brought a small artificial Christmas tree that she had decorated for his room, because hospital rooms and mental institutions are not happy places.
Right.
And I just realized that this guy who had given the world so much joy was not getting it himself. And so when we became friends, it was just a wonderful time. And my wife and I and he and his wife, we would just go out to dinner all the time. And because they were a young couple, it was like dating teenagers in love. We just had a lot of fun and a lot of laughs. And we were a foursome for a very long time. And so in coming to write this massive update, which is, for those of you who have the original book, the update is more than half the length of the original book. It's kind of like getting two books in one. In the course of writing the update, I'm no longer on the outside looking in. I'm on the inside. And now I remember that back in 1978, when I was interviewing his friends, the people he trusted, they were very careful in what they said, not to cross the line of friendship, not to betray him.
Right.
So I'm now writing and thinking, how do I do the same thing? And so the line that I drew for this edition of the book was that I'm not going to write about anything that isn't specifically about things that happened in public or things that related to his artistic evolution and growth that I actually witnessed or was part of. And there are a few places where, you know, I wondered to myself, am I crossing the line here? But they were decisions that I grappled with and decided to include a few things that I think were really important.
Like what? Where did you have to make that decision?
I'll give you two examples. One in the battle to get rid of Dr. Landy,
okay.
Diane Sawyer was did a big primetime live expose on him, and nobody knew that I had been as Diane Sawyer's producer came to call me Beach Throat. I was the source of a lot of information in the compilation of the story, so I wrote about that because that seemed like an important thing for the reader to know about me and the story. Mm-hmm. But the one that I felt that pulled me the most was when Brian started working on, started vocal rehearsals for the Brian Wilson Presents Smile. So all throughout the fall of 2003, he had been working to figure out how to assemble these songs into a coherent whole. Some of the songs needed finishing, some needed new lyrics, some needed melody. And in the summer of 2003, Brian and I had been walking back from the movies, and he had said to me, excuse me, Brian had said to me, hey, David, I want you there every step of the way while I'm working on finishing Smile. I need you there. And it's like, well, Brian, I've got a company, a production company I'm running. I'm making documentaries. And how can I be there every day unless I'm making a documentary about all this? And so we talked about it, he and his wife and I, and we decided to make this film documenting the completion of Smile. And on the second day of shooting, we're in his house in the music room upstairs, and Brian gets up and says to everybody, I'll be right back. And a few minutes later, the musicians take a break, and they come back from their break, but there's no Brian. So I go downstairs, and Melinda is in her office, and I go, isn't Brian downstairs with you? And she says, no, I thought he was up there with you. And she looks out the window, and his car is gone. And we get a call from the emergency room at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica that's where Brian is, and we all go there. And the reason I felt it was okay to include my part of the story in this is that part of the story is told by Melinda in the documentary Beautiful Dreamer, where she says, we're in the room, and she says, Brian, do you want to stay here? Do you want to go out to dinner? And he says, okay, let's go out to dinner. He decided that was a lot better than staying in the hospital. Right. So we're walking on the sidewalk back to our cars, and Brian and I are walking about 20 feet or so ahead of Melinda and my late wife. And they're talking, we can't hear them, and we're talking, and they can't hear us. And I said to Brian, look, maybe, you know, one of the hardest, if not the hardest things I ever said in my life, I said, look, if finishing Smile is going to make you sick, we need to stop now. And he said, no, I have to do it. I have to do it. And that's the story that I just, do I put this in the book or not? And I felt it was so pivotal to the story of Smile, as well as his and my friendship, that I decided to include it.
You know, one thing that goes on, I wanted to ask you about is when he...
What do you think, Manfred? Did I cross the line there?
No. I mean, and it ties back to the documentary. I mean, it's a hard thing, David. I have to say, as I'm reading the book, you know, it's, as you said, this journalistic aspect, and then now you're from this this other side, this other perspective, and you begin to wonder, well, now it's reading more like a David Leaf memoir, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm finding out more about the different projects you've worked on, and I think it's a difficult thing, but overall, I mean, I'm, you know, it's all ultimately part of the Brian Wilson story. And if you hadn't done this update, I think the update brings into focus all these incredible things and the flourishing of this man's life, that is only maybe at best hinted at from that the first update that you did, the 85 edition. And I mean, it makes the story far more complete. And it also, I mean, that perspective is from an inside thing, and that you know, there's objectivity that's lost. There's like humanity that's gained, right? I mean, it's you.
I like that.
I'm going to
steal that next time I'm asked the question.
Because part of the story is the feelings too, right? Everything with the Wilson is not as much what he thinks. He can think of something. But what drives his soul, his creative soul, and his sort of his person is, you know, the kind of feel, the summation of all these emotions. And you're able to tap into that. And so, no, I don't think across the line. I think you're right to consider those things. But, you know, the story is more certainly more complete knowing about it. So that's my answer that I'm sticking to.
You know, it's funny. People talk about journalistic objectivity. Even in the first book, because of all the things I had read, I'm not sure how objective I was in the first book.
Well, you definitely have you're on the mission, right? So that's, yes. I mean, that's got an angle to it right there too. And like, you know, a hypothesis, a thesis, and you're trying to find the evidence that that supports it, you know.
I like that too.
Yeah. Well, you may freely use that as well.
I'm stealing everything, man.
So just to, I don't want to hold you much longer, but there are a couple more things I wanted to touch on. One thing that you don't talk much about in the book, and I thought this was interesting, is Brian finally gets the solo album out, despite Landy's involvement, or because of Landy's involvement. You know, it comes out, and that's like the same year that the Beach Boys have like their last number one with Kokomo. And you don't talk much about Kokomo. It's just kind of like a line about, oh yeah, the Beach Boys had this number one hit that year. I wonder, in a way, that's like a, you know, the Beach Boys are able to have a hit again. And that's great for their career. And Brian is finally able to get a official solo album out. And that's a pinnacle for his career as well. So is that not a great year for everybody involved?
Especially John Phillips and Scott McKenzie. A fair criticism of every edition of the book has been it's been more about Brian than the Beach Boys. With this update, I really wanted to celebrate, you know, what he's accomplished and what what's happened in all these years. To mark his 80th birthday. And the main thing I have to say about Kokomo in the book is that Brian to this day regrets not being on it. Landy wouldn't let him go to the session to sing on Kokomo.
Yeah.
Kokomo to me it's a hit record. Beach Boys fans can love it, but in terms of what the Beach Boys mean to me, in musical history, it's a coincidence. It's more that they were in a video with Tom Cruise that became a big hit. And Carl Wilson, of course, has just a great, great lead vocal when he sings about Kokomo. But I didn't think there was anything significant to say about it.
Yeah.
Which is why I said what I said. In terms of the Beach Boys' 50th anniversary, you could ask the same question. There's just a couple of sentences about that.
Right.
Well, by then, as I wrote in the book, my life was in a different situation because of what was illness in my family, and I didn't go to the 50th anniversary tour. I wasn't there when they made the record, so I didn't really have anything firsthand to offer. And I really wanted the update to be what was indisputable, what I saw, what I experienced, right, what people I trusted experienced, and this journey with Brian had to include, you know, what you talked about, where I write about some of my other projects, because in a way a lot of them became relevant, like being in the studio when the Bee Gees, when Barry Gibb sang the lead vocal on Too Much Heaven, and then two decades later, I'm in a hotel room and Barry's teaching Brian the lead vocal on Too Much Heaven. I mean, there's just, there's a certain serendipity to it all. A good, good friend of mine in England, Mike Grant, emailed me when he was reading the book, the update part of the book. He said, "I feel like I'm reading your diary." And I emailed back. I said, "Is that good or bad?" And he said, "I'll let you know when I'm finished." But I think.
Well, what did he say? When he finished.
He loved it, but I don't need to pat myself on the back in that regard. What I do think was important in talking about myself was that the reader understand who I am. Who am I to say these things? There's right, a long okay. author's note in the book that explains what I got right and what I didn't get right necessarily in the first edition of the book. The idea is I never worked for Brian Wilson. I was never his manager. I was never his publicist. Just his friend. And as his friend, I wanted the world to understand him better, to get a better sense of who he was. And people assumed, because I was around a lot, that I must be working for him.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. And you know, my late wife was very shrewd about a lot of things. And she's, you know, because Brian was always bugging me to write songs with, always. And I've written lyrics for songs with other people, but she said, "You can't do it because all of Brian Wilson's lyricists become his ex-friends. They become his former friends. So don't do it." And it was frustrating to Brian. It wasn't like he needed someone to sit down and write verse chorus. He needed somebody to finish a sentence or whatever. So right. It would have been a very easy thing to do, because I have a certain glibness and facility with rhyming. But that wasn't my job in life. My job in life was to be his friend. And
right, but wait a minute, David, because he has you come in the studio at some point and he has you sing something and records that.
Yes.
What is that? Can you remind me?
Well, I was when he was recording Brian Wilson Presents Smile, during the section where there are animals making animal sounds, I was in the control room and he asked me to come out and make an animal sound. So I was a sheep, meh, meh, or a goat. I don't know which that is. So, but you know, he loved what he called casual singing. If we could riding in the car and listening to the radio and singing along to the radio. I remember one time I lived in an apartment building where there was a big courtyard and we'd have parties in there. And one year we had a karaoke party and my older brother and I got up on stage with Brian and he was Dion and we were the Belmonts and he sang Teenager in Love. Now, people's image of Brian Wilson is not somebody getting up at a party and singing, right?
Yeah.
But what he loved was being what he loves is being treated as a regular person, not somebody who's going to make money for you. He has been surrounded his entire life by people trying to figure out how they can make a buck off of him. And I was quite determined not to be one of those people.
Well, David, do you have another, let's say, 10 to 15 minutes?
Sure.
All right. So two main things I want to touch on.
I thought you were asking me if I had 10 to 15 minutes left in my life.
Well, certainly you do. But, you know, I want to see if I can get at least that much out of you here.
You got it. Whatever you need, Manfred.
Well, so there are two other main things I wanted to bring up. One is Mike Love, and then the other is Brian's relationship with Paul. And you make a point to say in the new edition, so to be clear, especially in the early days, Mike Love was songwriting partner with whom Brian Wilson had the most success, or Brian had the most success. Why did you feel it necessary to state that?
Well, as I say, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, because I stated it because I wanted to acknowledge that indeed that was a fact. But in I think the next paragraph, I then list all the other people Brian has written successfully with.
Yeah.
He wrote In My Room with Gary Usher and Don't Worry Baby, Little Deuce Coupe with Roger Christian, and God Only Knows and Wouldn't It Be Nice with Tony Escher, and Heroes and Villains with Van Dyke Parks. etc. The point I wanted to make was that, yes, Mike was indeed the most successful lyricist in the Beach Boys' hit-making years. But Brian could write a song with anybody.
Yeah.
He wrote Surfer Girl by himself. He wrote Till I Die by himself. Beautiful songs, perfectly serviceable lyrics. The Beach Boys are not going to be known for their words. The Beach Boys are going to be known for the feeling that the music gives us. You think of people at a concert singing along to the high part at the end of Fun, Fun, Fun. That,
right.
That's the feeling of the Beach Boys that we take with us. People didn't even know what Don't Worry Baby was actually about. It was about a car race. But it's a beautiful lyric. Don't worry, baby, everything will turn out all right. So it's a great, great sentiment that fit the song. So I wanted to make the point because I have been criticized in the past, most notably by Mike Love, that I don't give him credit for what he did.
Well, in the book, though, I think it's the first edition, you brought to light some things I wasn't aware of, that Brian and Mike sitting in a car all night listening to the radio, that Mike, there's some song about a soldier that he performs, I guess, to the family or something of that effect. Well,
so before the Wilson and Love families were close, and then at some point, I think even before the Beach Boys started as a group, the families had some sort of disagreements and weren't as close. So there were events, Christmas parties, Christmas caroling. There was a song that Mike Love wrote. I think Mike might have been 9. And Brian sang it at a kind of a family recital. And there were two versions of the song, the original one that Mike had written and a rewritten one that had a lyric by Murray Wilson, Brian's father. So even right from the very beginning, there was tinkering going on. In terms of Mike and Brian's friendship, apparently Brian would go over to Mike's house to listen to rock and roll radio, rhythm and blues radio here in Los Angeles before there was rock and roll radio. And they would be listening to the black station in town. And at some point, Mike's father would throw him out of the house and they would go out into the car and listen to the radio and maybe spend the night in the car listening to the radio. And Mike wrote a song called Brian Is Back, in which he describes that scene like teenage gamblers sitting in a Rambler, something like that. So Mike was, you know, they were very close. Brian through the years has been asked in interviews, you know, does he want to work with Mike again? And in documentaries and other interviews, he invariably says, no, I don't, his ego is too much for me.
Yeah.
And what exactly that means, I don't know. But my guess is that, you know, Brian was the big deal. He was the big cheese. He ran the Beach Boys recording career. And he didn't want static. He wanted that radio station to come in clearly. And so I think Mike was static. That's what I've been told in Mike's book. He will deny it, but I've spoke to an awful lot of eyewitnesses who said the contrary. So Mike doesn't like me, and you know, I haven't talked to him, I think, since Brian's wedding. So that's almost 30 years.
In June 2002, I think that's when Brian and Paul McCartney sing together for the first time.
June 2002, they Brian and Paul are part of an all-star cast at a Queen's Jubilee benefit.
Okay, that's right. All right.
And then Brian plays a landmine benefit with Paul where they sing God Only Knows and Let It Be together. Okay. which is just one of those magical moments. If you're a Beach Boys fan, a Brian Wilson fan, what's fascinating about it is in the local television station, when Brian was asked, they had a report on it on that night's news, and Brian is asked, you know, are you nervous? And Brian goes, well, yeah, he's Paul McCartney. and last year, at Brian's website, or his Facebook page, rather, he's asked, if you could be anyone other than you, who would you be? And he holds up a piece of paper with Paul McCartney's name on it.
I'm glad you said that, because that was the next thing I was going to ask you about. But
they have a relationship. You talk about astrology. They were born 2 days apart, same year, same month, June 18th and 20th.
They're Geminis.
Geminis, and Brian is 2 days younger. And Brian one time called Paul, he called him Old Man Pablo. I don't think there's anybody else except maybe, you know, his kids or his wife who could get away with calling him Old Man Pablo. we just all turned like in a whiplash. It's like, what did he just say? Old Man Pablo?
So, you know, you touch on this a lot, Brian's great sense of humor and how humor is so important to him. I love this quote. He says, you know, Debbie, no matter how bad it gets, there's always something to eat, which I thought was pretty great.
He is funny. Sometimes intentionally he'll put you on. Sometimes he'll say things that, oh, he couldn't mean that, but he does. But you'll laugh first and then you'll realize he means it. Smile was designed to make people smile, to make them laugh. That was the whole point of the record. If you went to YouTube, somebody posted a link of Beautiful Dream or Brian Wilson and the Story of Smile. It's posted a number of times, but there's a 2-hour post of it because after the closing credits, there's a conversation I have with Brian right after he returned from the first Smile tour in England. And he is as happy as anyone has ever seen. He's happy because finishing Smile made him happy. Playing Smile made him happy. And in the course of the interview, I asked him to compare Smile and Pet Sounds. And he said, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I give Pet Sounds a 4 and Smile a 10. And it's like, seriously? And it's like, well, yeah, Smile's happy music, David. Now, in a subsequent interview, he said, "Smile, Pet Sounds is a 7, Smile is a 10. So he clearly loves Smile more than Pet Sounds. He does love to laugh. He was a prankster in high school. He was a prankster in the Beach Boys years. There's pictures of him that you can see. Him sliding down the he had a swimming pool in his house. He's going down he's sliding down backwards with his open mouth open. He's just laughing hysterically. He had joy in life. He was searching for joy in life. But ultimately, the demons got to him. Where those demons came from, nobody knows. And fortunately, the completion of Smile seem to exercise a lot of those demons for him.
Vignettes or some story in the book about you and your late wife, him performing it and almost being able to visualize like something leaving him, like
this is during the world premiere of Brian Wilson Presents Smile at Royal Festival Hall in London. Brian got this enormous standing ovation afterwards that lasted for a very long time. And he tried to stop the audience. Like if you watch the end of the film, he goes up to the microphone and goes, hold it, hold it. And the audience just gets louder because this is a dream, not just of mine. People from all over the world come to see the world premiere of Smile. They've come from Tokyo. They've come from Cape Town. from Europe, from LA, from New York. I mean, they come from all over. It's a big deal in what you might call the cult of Brian Wilson. Mm. When he steps back from the microphone, there's a deep sigh. And sometime after that sigh, I see something. I see what looks to me like demons flying out of his head. And it's like, okay, I'm hallucinating. But I haven't had anything to drink. I've never done drugs. And I turned to my late wife and I said, did you see that? And she said, yes. I said, describe it to me. And she describes exactly what I had seen. Now, that sounds pretty crazy, doesn't it? In the course of interviewing Brian for the Beautiful Dreamer documentary, I asked him the question, when you finished Smile, did you feel like the demons had left you? And he said, yes. Now, sometimes when you're interviewing him, he'll just mimic what you've said. So I didn't know if he was doing that at that time.
Yeah.
But in subsequent interviews, I've heard him say, when I finished Smile, the demons left me. It just made him so happy to play that music. You watch him and it's like, who is that guy? and you, there are any number of cliches, you know, the albatross around his neck, whatever, you know, it was all gone. And we all believed that if and when he did that, he would be freed to write new great music. And a few years later, we were back at Royal Festival Hall for a world premiere of a new rock opera called That Lucky Old Son, based on an old song Brian had loved. And when I had suggested to him that he not call it S-O-N, as it is in the song, but S-O-N, because it would refer to his father and the irony of him not necessarily being that lucky old son,
yeah,
he just looked at me and said no. Because he does not have an ironic bone in his body. He doesn't have a mean-spirited bone in his body. He's the sweetest person you could ever meet.
David, so this, you completed the update for the most recent edition. Are there any upcoming adventures with Brian that you know of that are in store for us? I mean, he'll continue to make music, I hope.
That's a God only knows answer.
Yeah.
I don't know if Brian wants to make music, he will.
David, thank you so much for joining me today on our Coolers Conversations.
Okay, it was great to be with you.
I've been speaking with author David Leaf about the updated edition of God Only Knows: The Story of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and the California Myth, which is available from fine booksellers everywhere. Right now, we'll take a listen to Good Vibrations, courtesy of the Beach Boys, here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. Picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations.
The Beach Boys laying those good vibrations on us here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to author and Peabody Award-winning director and producer David Leaf for joining me to talk about his updated edition of God Only Knows, the story of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and the California Myth. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcasts, both parts 1 and 2. And please join me again next week for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.